Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Chuck Morse. Chuck Morse Speaks Blog Talk Radio podcast. We'll be joined shortly, hopefully, by Timothy P. McCarthy. He's an adjunct lecturer on public policy and a program director at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Tim came to my attention because he's the co-founder of a group called the Resistance School, which has been formed in response to the Trump administration. And let's see, we're waiting for Tim to call shortly. Obviously, this is interesting to me that that Harvard would be basically training young people to resist the policies of President Donald J. Trump. And I suppose that the main line of my questioning would be, is this simply an overall opposition to the president because he is President Trump, or are there specific issues that the group wants to take on? And if so, what are those issues? How do they plan to take them on? What do they plan to do? And we're joined by Professor McCarthy. Tim, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Great. I've introduced you, Harvard Kennedy School. You're an adjunct professor, Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. You've recently been part of forming a group called the Resistance School in response to the Trump administration. So
yes.
I suppose my first question is exactly are you specifically resisting or opposing policies of the administration, or is this an overall opposition to Donald Trump as president?
Well, I think that the first thing that we are interested in is trying to find a way to create communities of resistance, not just here in our own community, but in communities across the country and even the world, and to try to imagine what a more just and more equal and more free society would be, where a greater number of people can live with rights and dignity and have opportunities to flourish and not be under threat and under siege and under surveillance in a world that's increasingly divided and treacherous. And so I think part of what our work is seeking to do is to not just imagine what that world would be like, but then to build skills and to build bonds of community that will help us lay the foundation for that better world, to bring it about.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I certainly am with you on the issue of the increase in surveillance. I mean, this was an issue that was exposed a couple of years ago by Edward Snowden, who revealed that the NSA was had the ability to eavesdrop on our conversations by cell phone and look at our keystrokes. And we know that President Obama actually enhanced that by allowing for greater surveillance of the cell phone. But what is this? I mean, are you specifically asking the Trump administration to do something about this? And if so, what?
Well, one of the things that I think is important to understand about Resistance School is that we're not, though individual people who are a part of it, myself included, my students, other colleagues, and folks we've been in contact with since it started, are all going to bring, each of us is going to bring our own policy agenda, our own values, our own sense of what is right and wrong to the project. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to create spaces where we can create communities that can come together to debate these things, and understanding that there are going to be differences that, among us, and that we're going to have to work through some of those things. But we also think that this is an opportunity in our history. I call it a movement moment, where we can try to figure out how we can come together despite those differences within those debates, to have them, to navigate differences, to come up with some kind of common good. And for me, that common good has to start with an assessment of what we value most, what we cherish most, and what we aspire to in common as a nation, as a people, and to try to move us in that direction. I think if we get hung up on which politician has done the worst thing this week or this day, or which particular policy we may have a disagreement about, then we get stuck in the mud and too deep in the weeds. And so I think first of all, mm-hmm. we have to come together in a moment where I think a lot of us are feeling under siege, where a lot of us are feeling that the divisiveness of our politics is undermining our ability to actually engage in a common good, to imagine it and to build it. And so the Resistance School is seeking to create a community and communities, both in virtual space because of the online platform, and then also in real space where different people gather in different groups all over the place, not just here at Harvard, but elsewhere too. The first session that I helped to lead was viewed by folks in 50 states and 20 countries. Tens of thousands of people tuned in, and that's only grown since that time. And so we're not trying to say, okay, here are the positions we need to take on individual policies, although a lot of us have lots of opinions about that. But mm-hmm. we're trying to say, what kinds of skills do we need to do work to resist the things that we need to resist, to build the things that we need to build, and to move ourselves in a direction that is getting us closer to a world filled with justice. And so, you know, I mean, I have my own views about Donald Trump. I have my own critiques of what he's doing and what he's saying, and I have my own critiques of what President Obama did. I also have things that I admire about President Obama. And, you know, and we can talk specifically about policies, but for us, what we're trying to do is create an educational environment, a community space where we can come together to have these conversations, to reflect, debate, and build momentum for a movement moving forward from this moment.
Well, Tim, even though you have the word, even though according to the Harvard Crimson, the Resistance School was set up in response to the Trump administration,
mm-hmm.
so I imagine it's opposition, and the word resistance is one of these kind of old-fashioned communist words, but we'll put that aside.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you're describing right now sounds to me like something that could include someone like, say, me, who is a Trump supporter and always
mm-hmm.
has been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it
mm-hmm.
sounds like you're trying to create a dialogue where people genuinely can differ. So I suppose that maybe the aspect of this, which is a response to the Trump administration, might be misplaced, at least from what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
But the
yeah.
specific
well,
policy that you have mm-hmm. mentioned is the business of the growth of the surveillance state, you know, the dark
mm-hmm.
state, whatever you want to call it, which is something that, I mean, I think that people who are supporters of President Trump would agree with you on. And it's something that sort of crosses, you know, ideological lines, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's something
mm-hmm.
that we could work together to take a look at. You know, we've seen that there's, you know, there's been possible Russian involvement, for example, both in the Trump campaign and also in the
mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And that now
mm-hmm.
there's Russian involvement in European politics. And it's being done through cyber methodologies that are troubling. So those are issues that I think we probably could find common ground on.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that there are places for us to establish common ground. There's no question about that. I mean, I think it should worry any of us who believe that Americans should have should be the ones who determine the outcomes of our elections, that Americans should determine and have a say in
right.
how we govern ourselves and what kinds of rights we seek to ensure and protect and advance. And I think that there's huge common ground there. I think anybody who is gleeful about the fact that that there was significant Russian involvement, it looks like, in our last election cycle, is someone I who's you know, devotion to American democracy, I would question. And I'm not one to be quick to call people unpatriotic, because I've been called unpatriotic myself for all sorts of crazy reasons. But I'm not one to try to police that. But I do think that if you're so partisan that because of that involvement from outside forces, your candidate may have won, then I think your devotion to democracy is less strong than your devotion to a particular kind of ideology or a particular kind of candidate that represents that or best represents that in any given moment. And so I think that there is an opportunity now, and I think we have to seize an opportunity to have conversations across partisan lines, across ideological divides. And if we live in a world where someone who supported Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton can't have a conversation with someone who supports supported Donald Trump or vice versa, then I think we're in much more perilous situation than we than I thought otherwise. And so, you know, we have to, but that's the thing. We have to create spaces where we come together to have those conversations, where we say to ourselves, okay, look, what do we have in common? What do we have that's not in common? What values do we have that might align despite our political differences? And what kinds of things can we work together on? What can we agree about? And I think that the growth of the, you know, the dark state, the increase in surveillance, the challenges of cybersecurity, which are real and growing, and you know, in many ways transpartisan, those things should be cause for concern for all of us. I think, you know, economic inequality is an issue that I think a lot of us can find common ground on. I mean, there are a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump, who supported Donald Trump, who are operating from a reality of economic inequality, that they feel that their American dreams have been dashed. They feel that they don't have access to the kinds of resources and opportunities that other people have had access to. And there are also some of us, you know, who may not be on the downside of that inequality, but who nonetheless are deeply concerned about it, because we know that whenever we have inequalities and whenever we have growing divides between people in terms of their access to opportunities and resources, we're living in a more difficult society, one that is not living up to its promise, its founding promises of freedom and equality and the rights of opportunity. And so, you know, I think there are broad areas rooted in common values that we can work together on. That said, there are going to be issues where we disagree quite significantly, right? So, I mean, I opposed the executive order instituting a travel ban from certain countries that were predominantly Muslim. You know, I'm not in favor of building a big glorious wall. You know, I think it's wrong to cut funding for the NEA and the NEH. And so those might be specific areas where you and I or some people may have differences. But, you know, we have to engage with differences, lean in, have those contentious conversations, and also work harder than we are right now to find common ground. And that's my concern. I'm very much trying to figure out how in this moment I can be what I called in my first resistance school lecture, a bridge builder and a boundary crosser. How can I move outside of whatever bubble I may live in and engage other people who may also live in bubbles, different bubbles from mine, but bubbles nonetheless, and how we can try to work across those divides. Because if we just stay in place where we are across those lines of difference and division, then we're never going to build the kind of community that I think will have the best chance of realizing the ideals and promises of our and possibilities of our democracy.
Well, Tim, you know, I think that you know, this past election has been one of the most divisive elections since probably the Civil War. And certainly in my lifetime, I've seen it. Sure. I mean, I've seen it affect people that I know, people in my own family, who in ways that I've never seen, which makes me think that it's not so much Donald Trump as a person, although that's part of it, but the movement that he represents. And you're talking about creating a movement. In order to create a movement, I think you have to have very specific principles that you stand up to and even emulate, and Trump does that, and his thing is a movement, but it's really a revolutionary movement, and he is a revolutionary figure in many ways.
How do you define that?
Well, it comes down to something very simple, and it's an actually a revolutionary idea that seems conventional on the surface. And should be conventional, but yet it's not something that's been articulated in many, many decades. And that is the idea of putting America first. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this is something that, I mean, Obama, the Bushes, they did not articulate that. They did not accept that. They were much more into sort of a globalist idea, and I think a diminution of the United States so that we could become a part of a province of the world. And Barack Obama spoke about being a world citizen, and Trump, basically, whether or not he actually does is another story, but at least in his rhetoric, he rejected that, and he made the common sense statement that American interests and American national sovereignty would be first because we are Americans. And I mean, if we lived in Zimbabwe, I would expect the president to say we have Zimbabwe first. I mean, it's it's kind of a natural thing for a sovereign state to put the interests of its own citizens. It's actually a very progressive idea, a very democratic idea. So I think that because he articulated that simple concept, that is what propelled him, and that's what makes him and his movement quite revolutionary. It really is a shift that this country hasn't seen probably since the administration of Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things about that. I appreciate what you just said and mapping that out and identifying specifically what you think is new or revolutionary in your words about this. And I think there are some things there that I'd like to respond to. First is the idea of America first and that we're a sovereign nation. And I agree with you that we should be in control of our own destiny. That is absolutely true. And so if America first means that Americans get to determine the outcome of their elections, get to determine how they govern themselves, get to determine which institutions they think should be supported and which institutions need to be reformed or changed, then I absolutely agree with you. And you know, I've spent my entire life as an American living in the United States, mm-hmm. but for a summer where I spent some time in Ireland, where my dad's family's from. So I've lived here my whole life. I've been an American citizen. I voted in every election. I've paid my taxes, and I've even studied the history of the United States. I'm an American historian. I have a PhD in American history, so I have a pretty decent understanding of it. And so you know, I have put America first and American history at the center of my work for my whole life. And so, you know, I'm sympathetic to the feeling that comes from that kind of a statement. That said, I think that there are some complications there. So one complication for me goes back to what we started talking about at the very beginning, which is that our last election was interfered with by another sovereign state that is not this sovereign state, and agents in Russia who were interested in affecting and in determining the outcome of this particular election. And it looks very much, at least at this point, we don't have all the information, of course, because the investigations are ongoing, that the Trump campaign was deeply involved in conversations and meetings, face-to-face meetings, and who knows what else, with those outside forces of another sovereign state who are seeking to influence this election. So for me, the claim of, you know, make America, you know, America first is complicated by the fact that that kind of interaction and engagement, if not collusion, was happening throughout the campaign and had some influence on the election. So I think when we think about America first, we have to think about how that factors into that. Another thing for me that complicates it with Donald Trump is that Donald Trump, in addition to saying America first, has also been very clear about putting himself first, and that his business dealings, which is the thing that he ran on as his kind of area of expertise and success and achievement, is by definition, his own definition and admission, incredibly global. That this is a man who has made an enormous amount of money. We don't know how much because he hasn't yet fully documented that with the release of his tax returns, which is also a break from recent history. And he hasn't done that in But we know that his money, because he talks about it all the time, his money has been made off business deals all over the globe, right? So Donald Trump himself, economically, socioeconomically, in terms of the experience he brings to the work he does, and in terms of the background, how he's lived his life, has been one not of making America first, but of going anywhere else in the world he needed to in order to put his own private business self-interest first. And so that to me also complicates the full-throated way in which he often says America first. So I think that his claim of America first is something that is, it sounds good and it feels good, and many of us can engage with it in a way that seems positive. But I also think there are complications there. I think that there are even contradictions in terms of his own actions and the actions of the people who work with him and for him, and in the work that he's done in the world for the 30 or so years that he's been out as a businessman in the world. So, you know, it's not easy. And I think these speak to the fact that it's not easy for America to hermetically seal itself or wall itself off from the rest of the world. We just don't live in that kind of a world. I think that when you talk about the kind of globalism of someone like Obama or even George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, others, you know, that was certainly an aspiration that they put forward, but it was also a recognition of reality, that the world is more interconnected, that people are moving more than they used to move before, that migration patterns have accelerated, that capital flows across borders, people flow across borders, ideas flow across borders, culture flows across borders. And to deny that we live in that kind of a world, I think, is just foolish at this point, because we are so interconnected. And that means that America has to, whether it likes it or not, or whether we as Americans like it or not, we are playing in a world. We're a player, and we're a powerful player in the world. Just this past week, right, we've seen the president, doing things in other lands and authorizing bombings and military engagements and conversations with other heads of state from all over the world. And so how do you factor that, those realities, into a claim that America's first? If America first means that we're going to wall ourselves off from the world, and the only engagement that we're going to have with the world is making money off of them or bombing them, right? Then that's not the America I want to put first. Right? The America I want to put
first
is an America that's based on founding ideals of freedom and equality and the rights of citizenship, an expansive notion of who can participate in democracies, the guarantee of freedom of speech and of assembly and of petition and of religion and of publication, mm-hmm. of press.
Yeah,
and so those are the kinds of things that I care about.
And as do all Americans. I mean, putting America
right.
first means all Americans. But I think there's a misunderstanding here. Firstly, the business about, I mean, I'm talking about the movement that Trump represents, not
mm-hmm.
necessarily him as a person. And that is a movement of putting the sovereignty of America first.
Okay.
Whether or not the Russians were involved, that's not proven either way. I mean, maybe who knows who they were involved with. I would think they probably would have preferred Hillary for president, given the fact that she had made those uranium deals with Putin. But we can put that aside, since none of that's proven. As far as the business, I mean, putting America first doesn't mean that we are pulling up a drawbridge at all. It means that we're putting ourselves first in the sense that we're going to deal with the rest of the world from a position of strength and from a recognition that we are doing our deals and leveraging our own nation in a way that benefits Americans first. It's not isolationism. I mean, this is a false canard. The fact that Trump does business internationally, that's not relevant to this at all. I mean, he is a very successful businessman. That's why, you know, small-time business people like me admire Trump, because he is one
of
us.
Of course.
But he's super successful at it, and he kind of stands as an example to everyone, I think, of inspiration, the idea of the successful entrepreneur, which is what America is all about, a nation of entrepreneurs and businessmen, certainly more than any civilization in history. But the idea of putting America first is not, you know, this is like a false paradigm. It's not that we are therefore not doing business in the world at all. Quite the opposite. We want to have international trade, and it's just that the idea is to negotiate it in a way that ensures that American workers, American labor, American business, American culture is advanced, not hurt. So, you know, there's been nothing said by Trump that would indicate that he or his movement stands for anything else. And I think that it's kind of a bit of a false characterization to suggest that putting America first therefore means that we are pulling up some kind of a drawbridge.
Well, I mean, this is I think that I appreciate the way you articulated that, because that's I certainly think that American interests, when we negotiate with the world, when we engage with the world, obviously we have to operate from a position of strength. Nobody who goes into any kind of negotiation wants to operate from a position of weakness. And certainly one, if you're the president of the United States or the commander in chief of the American military,
negotiations that have put us in a position of weakness. I mean, the example was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If you studied that, it was not one that benefited American workers or American industry. Same thing with other of these sorts of agreements that were coming online. And on a diplomatic level, I would suggest that the Iran nuclear deal was not one that was beneficial. You know, it weakened the America's position in the Middle East. And this is something that's coming out from people who live there and who have been talking about this.
Yeah.
So,
no, I understand.
You know,
I understand
kind of
that.
It's a different way of approaching these things, both both economically and diplomatically and otherwise.
I agree with you, but there has been no single thing that has destabilized America's position in the Middle East than the way that the United States, in a fully bipartisan way, through now three presidencies, has conducted wars in the Middle East. The fact of the matter is that the Bush administration went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq as a direct reaction to the horror of 9/11, and I'm a New Yorker, so that was among the most painful days of our nation's life that I've lived through anyway, and went to wars under false pretenses in Iraq, for sure, where there were no weapons of mass destruction there, under false pretenses, with full-throated support from all sorts of people in the United States. I was not one of them. I was out in the streets protesting. I was marching. I was getting in trouble because I resisted both of those wars, because I understood that if you engage in war, boots on the ground, military interventions, the destruction of other people's sovereign nations for willy-nilly reasons or for fictitious reasons, as we know with the weapons of mass destruction claim, that has completely disrupted the Middle East. It's completely disrupted, obviously. It's decimated Iraq, and it's been incredibly destructive to Afghanistan. It has also unleashed all sorts of new movements in certain parts of that world, of people resisting the power of the United States, the military might of the United States, through the recruitment of people whose lives and countries and families have been destroyed by American warfare and military intervention. So if you want to talk about, I mean, the Iran nuclear deal, we can, you know, debate that all we want,
but
the Iran nuclear,
against those things. He said he was against the Iraq war. And the question of whether or not American intervention actually increased the advent of Islamic terrorism, or by not intervening, it would have increased more because they would have become more bold as they did during the Clinton years.
Okay, so I spend a lot of time with folks from the Arab world, and I have a lot of Muslim students and friends, and I've traveled to that part of the world. And the fact of the matter is that there isn't one person, no matter what their politics, there isn't one person that I have met in the Arab world or from the Muslim world who has said to me that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been a great thing for relations between the United States and the Middle East, that this has been a very bad thing. And that the wars, it would be very hard, and Donald Trump himself has criticized this.
Well, Tim, therefore you should have been behind. And by the way, I'm sorry to have to say this, but we're reaching the end of the program. It's a fascinating conversation. I'd like to do another episode.
Sure, me too.
Another
me too.
Time. And yeah, and, but that's exactly what Trump, the position that Trump ran on. But anyway, given the fact that we only have a minute, Tim, would you like to let people know how they can reach the Resistance School? Do you want to give out any websites or anything like
that? Sure, yeah. The website is resistanceschool.com, and it's available online free of charge. And there are four sessions, the third of which is tonight with my colleague Marshall Gantz, who's going to run a session on organizing, and who's a legendary organizer himself. And there's videos and readings and syllabi and all sorts of information there for anybody who wants to come. And we welcome all comers. That we're trying to build a community where we can have these debates and we can learn from one another and we can build a better country and world.
All right. My guest is Tim McCarthy. He's the adjunct lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and the organization is the Resistance School in response to the Trump administration. Tim, I want to thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And that is Tim McCarthy. Again, thank you for listening, everyone. I should mention that my books are available at Amazon.com. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S, like Morse code, and up they come. Also, my columns on Newsmax and my blogs, my podcasts are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And what's the fourth one? Tune in. Anyway, thanks so much. Again, this is Chuck Morse. Have a good day, everybody.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.